Rzeczywistość, liczby i obrazy. Czym dzisiaj jest nauka? Czemu służy wizualizacja danych? W jaki sposób są one prezentowane? Czym się różnią zwykłe wykresy od nowoczesnych map nauki przedstawiających pewne skomplikowane dane? I wreszcie, jakie korzyści czerpiemy z takiej ich prezentacji? O tym w rozmowie z profesor Katie Borner z Uniwersytetu w Bloomington. W lipcu 2023 roku w Bloomington w stanie Indiana odbyła się kolejna cykliczna międzynarodowa konferencja naukometryczna International Conference of Scientometrics and Infometrics. Zorganizował ją Uniwersytet w Bloomington pod patronatem Światowego Towarzystwa Info i Naukometrycznego ISSI. Jak zwykle konferencja była adresowana do specjalistów w dziedzinie szeroko pojętej informacji i zapraszała do aktywnej debaty na temat obecnego stanu i rozwoju teorii infometrycznych i naukometrycznych oraz ich zastosowania. Głównymi kierunkami są badania, rozwój i praktyka w zakresie bibliotekoznawstwa i informatyki, eksploatacji danych, wyszukiwania informacji, historii i filozofii nauki. Kilka sesji było poświęconych mapowaniu nauki, czyli graficznym reprezentacjom danych naukowych, które otwierają przed nami nowe przestrzenie eksploracyjne i analityczne. Wybitną w skali światowej popularyzatorką i badaczką map nauki jest Katie Borner, profesor na Uniwersytecie Bloomington. Katie Borner jest profesorem w zakresie inżynierii i nauk o informacji. To autorka licznych publikacji i pięknie wydanych albumów, trylogii o mapach nauki z indeksem Hirsza w wysokości 53 punktów i liczbą cytowań ponad 16 tysięcy. To właśnie profesor Borner jest główną bohaterką tego wywiadu. Drugim gościem jest profesor Wiesława Osińska, specjalista w dziedzinie wizualizacji danych i informatologii oraz autorka licznych publikacji i książek naukowych. Pani profesor wykłada w Uniwersytecie Mikołaja Kopernika w Toruniu. Pełni też w Polsce zaszczytną funkcję ambasadora wystawy Places and Spaces, która prezentuje mapy nauki stworzone przez międzynarodowe zespoły uczonych. Wystawę Places and Spaces można było oglądać w dużych miastach Polski i w wielu ośrodkach naukowych. Podczas konferencji na Uniwersytecie w Bloomington profesor Wiesława Osińska wygłosiła referat oraz prowadziła jedną z sesji tematycznych. To dzięki niej możliwa była rozmowa z profesor Katie Borner. Gorąco zapraszam do wysłuchania tego wywiadu. Mira Jankowska. Usually people think that science is a strong building in which everything, every discipline is well prepared, well positioned. And when I participate in this conference, I noticed that your presentation, I mean scientist here, is completely different. So what is the science now, in your opinion?
So there are many areas of science that are very well defined, like physics and mathematics and biology. But I think many of the major questions that we are asking scientists to solve, they really require an interdisciplinary approach. So researchers, experts, practitioners from many different areas of science have to come together to solve, for instance, global warming, to find the better vaccine, to understand how to deal with depression that now is happening after the pandemic is ending, but still ongoing. And so we are all interested to understand how to create teams that work effectively together, that can then communicate their expertise to the next team in line, that then helps translate the scientific results to more practical settings, including, again, administering vaccines, for instance, and ultimately help us all solve some of the more global and more long-term problems that we are facing.
But in your view, the science, how we can present to other, to ordinary people?
So since 20 years, we have been mapping science on a large scale. They are so-called maps of science, which look very much look like a world map. But instead of having Europe and Americas and Africa as continents, you now have continents that are labeled with mathematics and biology and social sciences and humanities and arts. And having such a two-dimensional map of our collective scholarly knowledge is valuable because you can then overlay other data. For instance, you can overlay career trajectories. Like I got trained in engineering, then I did my PhD in artificial intelligence, and then I did much research in information science, and now I'm also working in the biomedical sciences. So that's an entire trajectory that you can overlay. Another data overlay you might like to do is just looking at funding that certain areas of science enjoy. Some enjoy much funding and others very little funding. You could also overlay what kind of citation patterns exist. And in fact, the ISI conference is much about indicators, and indicators oftentimes use the number of papers and citation counts and the amount of funding that goes to a university to understand the strengths and weaknesses of institutions or experts or teams.
Usually, we used in my era of my studies and the school, secondary school, normal graphs to explain data. Yeah. Now you say we use maps. Mm-hmm. What is the plus of this new idea?
So many researchers do represent scholarly data using network graphs. So you would have nodes and edges. Nodes might be scholars, authors, and the edges might indicate that they collaborated together, they were featured on a paper together. So now you have a co-authorship network that shows how often two authors have collaborated together, were listed on a paper together. So you would have some nodes which are very big and dominant because they have published a lot of papers. And then you have some nodes that are connected by very thick linkages, meaning that they have collaborated a lot together. But then you might also have many, many nodes and edges that are rather small and thin. You can also do other networks, for instance, citation networks. One paper cites another paper, so that's a directed network. And these networks are rather large because there are now millions of papers that you could interlink that way. Some of my colleagues also use linguistic analysis. So you now go inside of a paper, you look at the words that appear in a paper, and you see how these papers are similar based on the words they are using. And you group them by those similarity linkages. And again, you have a network now that looks at the topical similarity of papers. And there are many other ways of creating networks out of scholarly data. Interestingly, many of us are not trained in reading these networks. So most of the users might not have a good understanding of what is betweenness centrality, or what is the degree of a node, or how do you do network clustering or pathfinder network scaling. And all of these algorithms are super important and valuable to experts, but they are not truly understandable to novice users. So by creating maps that look more like a geospatial map, people might feel more comfortable. They might even envision that they are at home in a certain area of this map of science, that they are an expert on mathematics, for instance, or biology, and so they can put their own place inside of that area on the map. And I think that makes them feel more at home. And then you could still have a slider that exposes the networks that underlies that geospatial map, but you wouldn't get to be scared by a network anymore. And ultimately, you might like to animate these maps over time, so these networks evolve. As new co-authors join, new papers get generated, these networks are evolving. And similarly, also these maps of science are changing over time. There might be wars raged on one end of the map because there's a scientific revolution going on. And there might be rather quiet areas where people are just happily doing their work in a very systematic and sustainable way. So I think it's interesting to have this map metaphor to make it easier for novice users to become familiar with a very abstract landscape of our collective scholarly knowledge.
Let's say something about charts, yes, because it's a step again behind, yes?
Yeah. So there are many different types of data visualizations that exist for scholarly activity. You can do a temporal analysis of scholarly activity, just number of papers over time or amount of funding over time to a person, to a team, to an institution, to a country worldwide. So you can aggregate that up. You can look at seasonalities. You can look at the impact of external events, like, for instance, World War I and World War II have created huge dips in the number of papers that were published, but it very quickly picked up and actually ultimately is a graph that can be explored in a very easy way that you have to cut out. You can then also do a geospatial analysis, so you can take a map of the world and you can overlay the scientific productivity of different scholars in different geolocations. So you will see that in bigger cities and urban centers you have more activity than in smaller cities. You can also overlay collaboration networks over a geospatial map of science, and that is done very regularly. Or you overlay the flow of experts from country to country to country, like I was trained in Germany, but I now work here in the US. You can then also do linguistic analysis. So again, you now study the words inside of texts, and that could be papers or patents or funding units. You can also do network analysis, and then now you're back with the networks where you are trying to understand what kind of actors interact with each other and how do they evolve over time and what network dynamics exist. And so all of this can be visualized using different types of data visualizations, be it temporal graphs or scatter plots, or be it geospatial maps or network data visualizations. Mm-hmm.
What do you think? What will be the next step when it comes to visualizing statistical data?
That is a great question. I think there's a lot of interest to visualize uncertainty in data. Some data is high quality, and then you could expose that in the data visualization. Other data, we know it's from potentially questionable sources, or we just know that it's of less quality. And that should be shown in the data visualization. Another really important topic that I think will attract attention is the visualization of feedback cycles in scientific data, but also in social science data. So for instance, feedback cycles might be that somebody gets hired at a university, gets nice startup funding, manages to use that money wisely to get some major data sets compiled, major software written, has a good paper out, and with that high quality document and paper in hand, is able to attract more funding, and then maybe can even buy out teaching, can hire a good postdoc, and that then spirals him or her up to have ever better production in terms of scholarly output, and also data and software artifacts that were nicely covered here at the conference. But you could also imagine an opposite scenario where you get a really nice software package and you have very nice startup funding, but then ultimately you might invest into something that is not successful. And now you don't have the publication, you can't hire the postdoc, you now have to teach more because you don't have the buyout of your summers. And now you have harder and harder times to actually get good papers produced. And so visualizing these kind of feedback cycles, which I believe make up much of the dynamics in science, is going to be super important. And we now have data that we can use to analyze these feedback cycles and to ultimately also visualize them. But there's very little work on this, so I'm looking forward to see more and more of the younger generations or the older generations go do that research and that data visualization.
Do you think that this is a future in the science, in your discipline?
So science of science studies are comparatively small. It's maybe 300 scholars around the globe. And then, of course, there are many more practitioners, right? Ideally, every science policymaker would use a little bit of data-driven decision-making. Maybe not extensively, but there is much data now available on what works in science and what does not work. And so just like many of us use data-driven decision-making when it comes to personal health or personal finances or our professional decision-making, I think also science policymakers might like to embrace the opportunity to take all that rich data and to make use of it. And so compared to some other domains of science, let's say neuroscience, where you might have hundreds of thousands of researchers, that's a very different size. So I think it's interesting for me to see that a rather small community can have a huge impact on how science is funded, how it's understood, how it's communicated, and how it's ultimately regulated, because you ultimately also need rules and regulations in place of how science should operate.
Did I correctly understand you said about 300 science of scientists?
300, yeah. So researchers that study science by scientific means, yes. Do you think it's much more?
Or less?
So I would think that the majority of them comes to the ISI conference, because every 2 years only. These are really the people which don't just look at indicators, but also care about bibliometrics and scientometrics and informatics, and ultimately also mapping science using scientific means. And so if you ask me to list names of people which really do science of science studies, there are not too many of them.
In Poland, they came from philosophy, philosophy of science. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And maybe it's also a matter of how you classify them, right? So I would, for instance, require that they do quantitative studies, because if you want to study science by scientific means, you would have to analyze that data. There are many, many in the 4S community which do very important qualitative science of science studies. So I think it depends on how you define the field. And that's actually a non-trivial first initial step for every single science of science study. So Kevin and Boyack today in their keynote, they defined a field by one journal and what that one journal is publishing. And then they showed how this journal operates in the context of all the other journals.
I saw a great album, Atlas of Science.
Trilogy. Yeah, and it will come to your institution.
Yeah.
Shipped.
Mm-hmm. but she meant the books.
Books. Yes, it's a trilogy.
Trilogy.
Yeah, because we would like that knowledge to come to you. Mm-hmm. And maybe, just maybe, then that other question gets answered. Because ultimately there is data that you can use to answer certain questions.
Thank you, Peter.
Can we talk a little bit about this trilogy, please?
And then you could even tell them, here, you come to this place in Warsaw, and you can look at it.
In Torun. Torun,
yes. I've never been to Torun. I was in Warsaw, and I loved it, because it's a very, very multicultural, very rich, vibrant city.
Torun or Warsaw?
Warsaw. I've never been to Torun.
Welcome. This is not too big city, like Bloomington, university city.
Yeah,
so,
very similar.
Yes.
A little bit similar.
Let's definitely talk when I'm. Mm-hmm. That is all resolved. But hopefully not soon, right? Because I love my parents.
Tym żarliwym zaproszeniem do odwiedzenia Polski i Torunia przez panią profesor Katie Borner. Kończymy pierwszą część rozmowy z nią. Katie Borner jest profesorem w zakresie inżynierii i nauk o informacji, wykładowcą w Uniwersytecie w Bloomington, światowej klasy specjalistą i popularyzatorką map nauki. A przypomnijmy, że towarzyszyła nam profesor Wiesława Osińska. O mapach nauki będziemy rozmawiać w drugiej części tego wywiadu, do wysłuchania którego już zapraszam. Na razie dziękuję Państwu za uwagę i do usłyszenia. Mira Jankowska.